Fact Chat.
Malcolm Turnbull announced that the laws of math do not apply here.
One of my favourite brands of comedy, Ariel, is brown people and black people making fun of white people.
Senators have been dropping like flies recently.
Shouting out the fact that in the Knowles-Carter family, women just have one name.
Fact Chat on FBI Radio.
Hello and welcome to Backchat, your freshest wrap of news and current affairs for the week. I'm Ariel Bogle.
And I'm Osman Farooq. Ariel, welcome back to FBI.
I know, I feel like it's been so long.
It's been a very, very long time. You've been away for like 3 weeks. We had Sam filling in, she was fantastic, but it is good to have you back.
It is good to be back. It's also good to be back this week. This is the week that Australia said yes to marriage equality, of course. The results came in and they were 61.6% in favour of marriage equality.
They voted yes for fairness. They voted yes for commitment. They voted yes for love. And now it is up to us, here in the Parliament of Australia, to get on with it. To get on with the job the Australian people have tasked us to do and get this done this year before Christmas. That must be our commitment.
That, of course, was our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, heralding the same-sex marriage survey results.
And look, I guess most of our listeners would be very across the top-line figures of 61%. Yes, people have probably been celebrating and partying as they deserve all week. But we thought we'd go a little bit beyond the top-line figures and find the stories that were playing out across Australia. And helping us with that today is Ben Rowey. He's a data analyst at GetUp, and he crunched a lot of the polling numbers for the Yes side during the marriage equality campaign. But he also runs the fantastic The Tally Room website, which is dedicated to election analysis. And he's joining us on the line to help us find out what happened, you know, a bit deeper than the top-line figures. How you going, Ben?
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. But look, let's start with the high-level result. As Ariel mentioned, it was 61.6% yes across the country. But how did that vary state by state and you know, within regions and cities?
Well, every state and territory voted yes, and almost every electorate in the country voted yes. So there's 150 individual seats in the country, and 133 of them voted yes. So when you look at the figures, there was variety in how high the yes vote was, unsurprisingly. It was highest in kind of inner city electorates, both kind of Greens Labor-friendly seats like Sydney and Melbourne, but also places like Wentworth and Warringah and Higgins and those kind of Liberal voting strongholds, but places that are relatively affluent and secular and progressive areas, whether they're Liberal or Labor voting. Those areas tended to be strongest, of course. But the swathe of seats that the yes vote won a majority in is actually very broad. Every seat in the three smaller states voted yes, as well as quite a lot of, for example, like regional seats, most rural seats around the country voted yes.
So, I mean, 61.1% is obviously a majority, but for people that are not so familiar with how statistics of this sort work, is that like a comfortable majority? Is that a result that says Australia overwhelmingly wanted this result?
Well, it's a little bit over 3 in 5 Australians who voted yes. And when you factor in the people who didn't vote, it's almost exactly half the country cast a yes vote, with about 3 million people effectively not voting. It's actually a really big result for a popular vote. Like, we don't do that many of them, but when we do, they very rarely get that level of support. We have, in this country, we have referendums to change the constitution, although we haven't had one. Some listeners may not have been alive for the last time we had one in 1999, and the last time we actually had a successful referendum was back in the 70s. So we don't do as many of them as we used to, but only 7 out of the 44 that have ever been held got a higher vote than this week's marriage vote. And most of those were on really quite dull topics. They were, should we say the judges have to retire at 70, or should we make small tinker to the way the Senate works? They weren't big, major, controversial social policy issues, let alone issues that if you cast your eye back 10 years, like, was not on the political agenda, was considered quite controversial. Indeed, we had 6 years of a Labor government not that long ago, and they weren't able to get it passed. So this is an issue that's moved really fast, and it's remarkable, I think, that we've gotten to a point where 62% of the country voted in favour of it. I mean, as another comparison, we've never had a government win a majority as big as 62% after preferences. Probably the highest was the 1943 election, when the Labour Party was in the middle of the Second World War and there was no official opposition party because the parties that eventually formed the Liberal Party had fallen to pieces. And even then, they got about 59%.
Wow.
So it's a good bit of history.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost unprecedented. It's quite a remarkable result. And I find it quite impressive that we didn't come out of it with large parts of the country that were polarised as yes areas or no areas. Nearly everywhere voted yes.
So we're going to delve into some of the geographic divides in a minute, Ben, but I wanted to ask you about turnout. There was some commentary, you know, when this process was being discussed earlier on in the year, that the whole idea of a voluntary, non-binding postal process was potentially designed to encourage certain demographics, older demographics in particular, who tend to be more supported, more opposed to marriage equality, to encourage them to turn out, and younger people who tend to be more supportive of marriage equality to deflate their vote. Did we see any evidence of that in this result?
So there was a little bit of a difference between the older vote and the younger vote. Younger people did tend to vote by a bit less, but it wasn't much. We're talking like 70% compared to mid-80s. It's not a huge difference, and I suspect part of the success of the campaign was encouraging young people to vote to make sure that gap wasn't bigger than it was. It is a phenomenon in other countries that have voluntary votes that you normally, whether or not it's a postal vote, you normally expect lower turnout amongst younger people. Older people generally are more likely to vote. And there's a bunch of reasons why that could be the case. And we had the additional ones in this case of the postal survey that young people are more likely to be travelling and may not have the correct address or things like that. I never really believed the idea that young people would be, you know, scared off by the postal process. You know, it didn't require a stamp. It was pretty simple. And I think most people are able to handle that pretty easily. I trust that young people can do that. And I think we saw that they overwhelmingly could.
And in fact, Ben, is it right to say that the youngest demographic, 18-year-olds, turned out even higher than people in their 20s?
Or 30s or 40s.
Yeah, wow.
That's absolutely right. So the ABS published the data in five-year age brackets by gender. And of all the demographic groups under the age of 50, the group that turned out highest was women aged 18 to 19.
Wow, that's fascinating.
And men aged 18 to 19 was a bit lower, but they were still higher than men in their 20s or 30s.
It was women in all groups, right, too. When you look at the spread, women in all age brackets voted the most. And that seems quite consistent with turnout, even in places that consistently have voluntary elections, like the US. Women always turn out the most.
Yeah. I mean, I think it varies from place to place about the turnout, but definitely here, all along, we... From the perspective of the Yes campaign, what we saw was that when we did our polling, we found that young people, regardless of gender, supported marriage equality, but young women were much more committed to actually making an effort to vote, whereas there was a lot of young men who believed in the principle of it but didn't care very much and were a bit agnostic about whether they would bother.
Come on, and man. So what are you doing? Wake up.
Nah, teenage girls always the best, obviously.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be serious, like we quickly realised that we could trust the young women to do the job, and that we needed to talk to the young men about making sure that they went to the trouble of getting it done. And I think like there's a small percentage gap between the men and the women, but those young men mostly did turn out, and it's very pleasing to see. But yeah, overall there was about a 4-point gap between women's turnout and men's turnout. Men turned out about 77%, and women about 81%.
So when, I'm sure people will be digging into these numbers for months to come, but when you look at the spread at the moment, you know, what factor was the most determinative of how people would vote? You know, age, demographics, location, what does it look like to you?
Age and gender, so we can't see this in the results because they didn't break the results down by age and gender, they only broke it down by geography.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, they didn't break it down into precise geography. Electorates are quite large, diverse areas that can include lots of different groups. But we did find that generally women were more likely to be yes voters and young people were more likely to be yes voters. When we did polling, even amongst older men, usually the yes vote was pretty strong, but it's possible that the no vote probably won amongst men over 65.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, most demographics were supportive, but younger people and women were more likely to be supportive. I'm pretty confident in that because we saw it in a lot of polls, but that hasn't come out. We don't know that from the results. The results tell us, like, what were the factors that varied between places? And the biggest factor does appear to be how religious an area is, which makes a lot of sense that places that had a larger proportion of the population who had a no religion, who answered no religion, tended to have a higher yes vote. So that meant the no vote tended to be higher both in sort of areas in the country that, you know, that there's a larger proportion of the population who are Christian, but it also meant higher in some more multicultural communities where more people are, well, quite a lot of those multicultural communities are also Christian, but also Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu or any other kind of religion. So it did seem that religion was the biggest factor. There does appear to be a bit of a relationship with class, that the yes vote was a bit higher in wealthier areas, which again makes sense. You think about places like the inner city of Sydney or the North Shore, places that voted, and the kind of equivalent communities in Melbourne and other cities. Those places did overwhelmingly vote yes. Those seem to be the biggest factors. There is a bit of a factor that it does appear that more multicultural communities were a bit more likely to vote yes, but it's not as strong a factor as religion, and I think there's a lot of different explanations for why that happened.
That's interesting. We're going to be chatting a little bit more about the result in some of those culturally diverse areas in the second half of the show. We're chatting to Ben Rowie. He's a data analyst at GetUp, and he runs the Tallyroom website, which is dedicated to election analysis. We've been talking about the breakdown of the yes and no vote across the country. Ben, the other thing that people were talking about in the lead-up to this vote was this idea that regional and rural areas are more conservative and they might be this bulwark of the no vote. How did that come out in this campaign?
Well, I mean, they weren't the most enthusiastic yes voting areas, but most regional electorates gave a majority vote to the yes campaign. Indeed, the only places where they didn't were a few seats in Queensland. So there were only three electorates outside of Sydney and Melbourne that voted no, and they were the seat that covers Toowoomba in Queensland, the seat that covers Mount Isa, and sort of doesn't quite cover Cairns, but it gets closer to Cairns. They voted no, and the seat of Maranoa, which is kind of the southwestern corner of Queensland. So all quite large rural inland electorates. Even the bigger regional towns in Queensland still voted yes, and in every other state, every regional electorate voted yes. So while, you know, there's still a decent proportion of those communities that are voting no, I think people, I mean, if I was a young queer person living in a country town, I would be encouraged by that probably there are more people, more supportive, more friendly people in those communities than you might imagine at first glance.
So we're running out of time, but just while we've got you in here as the guy that knows about election numbers, really need to ask you about what's going to happen in Bennelong. So, of course, John Alexander, the Liberal politician, is facing off Christina Keneally, the Labor I don't know, she's been around for a while in the Labor scene. She's been in and out of politics. What are the numbers looking like in that seat? Because that's a crucial one for the Turnbull government. And is it up for grabs?
I think it could be in play. I think if I was betting, I'd probably bet on Alexander to win, but not by much. He has a margin of about 10%, so that's kind of the starting point. It's worth bearing in mind that the overall nationally, the polls have swung about 5% since the last election, so that if you expect that you would see a swing like that in Bennelong, that's half of the job done. It is often the case, though, that you do get bigger swings in by-elections, particularly in unusual circumstances. So it is quite possible that you could see a swing as big as 10%. And indeed, there was a Galaxy, I believe it was Galaxy yesterday, that came out with a seat poll that had it at 50-50. So there's a big margin of error in those polls, and I wouldn't just rely on that, but I think it does indicate that Labor certainly has the potential to win. They kind of need everything to go their way, and that's what I'll be watching. And there's really big unknowns about how the community will react to both candidates. On the one hand, Christina Keneally has a high profile. She's quite an appealing politician. And there's some evidence that she remained more popular than her government, even while her government was very unpopular. But on the other hand, yeah, she was Premier of a very unpopular Labor government quite recently, and that might play a role. And we don't really know whether the community will have sympathy for John Alexander or blame him for his citizenship troubles. But that could also come into play if people think this was an unfair and arbitrary kind of fluke of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. People could vote for him overwhelmingly and say, well, it's his turn and he should go back in.
Totally.
But if people take a harsher view, then it could really hurt him.
Yeah, and given the government is in such a precarious situation in terms of its numbers in the House, it's definitely one to keep an eye on. Thank you so much, Ben Rowie, for joining us on Backchat this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up a little bit later in the show, we're going to be going a bit deeper into the Western Sydney result in particular. It's attracted a lot of attention this week, a lot of people pointing the finger at Western Sydney communities for the high no vote. We're going to chat to someone who grew up in the area, campaigned on the plebiscite issue over the last couple of months, and I guess get an alternative perspective on the result there. But right now we're going to play you this tune. It's by Omar Musa. It's a brand new one. It's his debut single off his new album, Since Ali Died. It's fantastic. It's called Assimilate, and it features Tamsin Keith. Check it out.
That was Omar Musa with his new track, Assimilate. You're listening to Backchat on 94.5. And so back to the yes vote, one of the big stories after the survey was the low yes vote in Western Sydney. And this was particularly striking, interestingly, in Labor seats. So in Blaxland, for example, that's held by Labor's Jason Clare, 73.9% of respondents voted no. And some sections of the media lasered in on this result, of course, making all sorts of claims about the type of people who voted in these areas. You know, was it religion? Was it conservatism? Was it race? As usual, the picture is a little more complicated. Here to talk us through it all is Carrie Ho, who campaigned for the yes vote in Western Sydney with a group called Democracy in Colour. Welcome.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Thanks for coming in. And so one thing that we spotted online was a Facebook post you wrote about this very issue.
And going viral.
It's going viral.
Apparently gives me authority now.
Yeah. Yeah, welcome to new media.
Yeah.
So how does going viral feel, first of all?
It is weird the amount of messages that I'm getting privately on my Instagram about my dog now. Oh. It's been really interesting.
You could have a dog celeb account now.
If it's boosted
I
your
could.
Instagram
I think people think my
fantastic.
Dog is gay now, so.
Excellent. So this Facebook post, I think it struck a lot of chords because it really dug into the narrative that's forming around why Western Sydney voted majority no. What prompted you to write it? What did you want to say?
I think it was really interesting because on the Wednesday when the Yes campaign obviously won and got announced, probably only just an hour later, I read a lot of media posts on Facebook, Twitter, but from big media companies about how this the high no vote in Western Sydney was due to race, due to multiculturalism, mm-hmm. blaming Chinese people, Muslim people.
The Great Australian Pastime.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it was kind of like, I'm queer and Chinese Australian, and I had literally an hour to celebrate the fact that the yes vote won, and then immediately had to deal with the racist discourse that arose, and that's what really prompted me to write this status.
And what were the main points that you wanted to convey? Was it just, were you just pushing back on that analysis, or from my reading of it, you kind of also went a little bit deeper to maybe explain what happened in the campaign that might have driven some of those results?
Yeah, look, I think what happened was, this government, when they put in this postal survey, we had about 6 to 8 weeks to really even organise. It was incredibly sudden, and it was an optional vote. So I think the Yes campaign was in a really weird situation where they already knew they kind of had a majority in Australia. So their political strategy was to ensure that people actually voted. But what that kind of means is that engagement is deprioritised. So places which is rarely politically engaged, especially on LGBT issues like Western Sydney, were ignored. And I really do think, from my campaigning in these areas, the No campaign banked hard on this. A lot of the events for the No campaigns were in these areas. Mm. A lot of the flyers that were being given out and the visibility of the No campaign were in Western Sydney, whilst there was there wasn't as much engagement when it came to the Yes campaign in these areas. And so many people who were in these areas talked to me about that. So many people who I talked to who are from culturally and linguistically diverse communities had very, very strange views on what this postal survey actually meant, which I found quite shocking. And that's the biggest thing I want to emphasize. These areas face a lot of barriers when it comes to political engagement and when it comes to LGBT education. And we need to be engaging these places rather than shunning them and telling them to secede from New South Wales, because what does that do?
Right. So we've seen like a lot of misinformation come out from the No campaign, arguably, mm-hmm. about what the vote meant. Did it mean if you voted yes, was suddenly there was going to be gay indoctrination in every primary school, that type of thing. And you mentioned this in the post,
yeah.
the fact that the No campaign did target these areas with mm-hmm. diverse backgrounds and language backgrounds. What were some of the examples of the stuff you saw out there and some of the misconceptions you corrected while you were campaigning?
Yeah, so it was so interesting because it was a lot of very, very old school homophobia that I hadn't seen since the 60s.
Right.
And it was specifically bilingual material that capitalized on this. There was a flyer going out in Chinese equating marriage, if same-sex marriage happens, AIDS is going to spread. If same-sex marriage is going to happen, men are going to pretend to be women and rape your children in bathrooms. If wow. marriage equality happens, the state is going to want people to cut off your son's penis. This is stuff that was specifically raised during the same-sex marriage debate in a lot of these communities. And a lot of people who I had reached out to had these really, really strange views when I talked to them about it. Like my parents, for example, they predominantly speak Chinese. They know English fairly well, but they're not as engaged with English media. And when I started bringing up the same-sex marriage debate with them, my mum had this really strange view that she said she heard in Chinese news about this, that same-sex marriage comes from the fact that people are gay because of food colouring. Food colouring in our food,
right.
As shown through the fact that icy poles can be red sometimes. It was really, really outlandish, things like this, and it shows the disconnect and the lack of education and the fear-mongering that really, really did occur during this campaign. And frankly, like, I am really, really worried. I feel as if this postal survey brought us backwards mm. when it came to LGBT education, especially in the culturally and linguistically diverse communities, which is quite upsetting.
So that's a really interesting point, because as you mentioned, the Yes campaign, it was quite a deliberate strategy. It wasn't we're not going to ignore people because we hate them. We've just got a certain amount of time, a certain number of resources, and we need to win this nationally. It's a national plebiscite. It's not really based on what happens in electorates. But do you think it raises another issue, and in the sense that it's not official figures from the Marriage Equality campaign that are pointing fingers at diverse communities, but there are a lot of people in the community that are. Mm. And do you think that is maybe something that wasn't taken into consideration, because now there is this narrative, this trope that's been set in, that we've got these great unwashed, Muslims, Chinese Australians who don't understand this stuff, and they're now the enemy. And like you said, they need to be kicked out of New South Wales or whatever.
I just find it really interesting that we're pitting minority against minority. We're pitting LGBT people against ethnic people. And the people that screws over is people like me, who is queer and an ethnic person. It's like, where do I kind of fit in? Mm. Who grew up like around Western Sydney? So, yeah, I do find this narrative really, really, really interesting considering that I don't think there is long-term engagement when it comes to LGBT mm. education in these spaces. This is a structural problem. This is something that we need to really hold our government accountable for, who have a lot of power when it comes to giving funding or deciding to put educational programs within schools or within communities to actually help LGBT youths who are in these areas.
Yeah, there's some really powerful things being said by people, queer people, LGBTQI people from Western Sydney who went to school there, went to mm-hmm. primary school there, sort of telling their stories about what it was like to grow up in those communities where they knew it would be very hard to find acceptance. So yeah, I guess I'm curious about like how we can start changing the narrative and making sure that, fighting for equal rights for these communities is not just a city pursuit, it's not just like a Eastern suburbs, inner west.
The solution to just move away from the area is just ridiculous. It's like, why don't you just move? And it's like, why don't you pay my rent?
Exactly. Like, what next? What?
I do think it's multifarious, the approach that we need. Sure. I think that from a grassroots perspective, I think there needs to be long-term engagement with Western Sydney. I know with Democracy in Colour specifically, we're really, really thinking about reaching out to different cultural community centres to actually push for LGBT education. Mm-hmm. I do think, for example, I do think something like safe schools is something that is so essential. Right. It's really, really unfortunate that the government isn't pushing for that, but I do think that would have been instrumental in preventing bullying and changing the next generation of people who are growing up in these areas and making them feel safer when it comes to LGBT issues, and even just creating spaces in Western Sydney that might that are pro-LGBT, which makes gives an area for these people to go to and gives visibility to LGBT spaces there. So people actually understand that being queer doesn't really change that much. Yeah. It's not going to, when your skin's not going to burn off if you hang out with us, you know?
Carrie, thanks so much for joining us and
You're
helping
welcome.
Us understand a bit more. It's Carrie Hoche is a campaigner for the Yes Vote with an organisation called Democracy in Colour, particularly focused on reaching out to diverse communities in Western Sydney. You're going to stick around for our next segment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The aerial is going to get set up for us.
Oh, I missed the air horns.
You missed air horns. When you're away from Oz for 3 weeks, the one thing you notice the most is the absence of air horns in your life.
Exactly. So, of course, this is a segment, Backchat Roulette, where we, you know, endorse, chat about some media that we consumed, the content we consumed during the week that people might have missed out on or that we just like to shout out.
Yeah, yeah.
What you got, Oz?
What have I got? I actually wanted to talk about Veronica Mars being on Stan as of yesterday. All 3 seasons? Yeah, it's good. It's fantastic. But no, that's not the real. That sounds like an ad for Stan. But the story that it got picked up a little bit, but in the midst of the marriage equality stuff this week, I don't think it got anywhere near as enough attention as it deserved. So Jacinda Ardern, new Labour MP from New Zealand, she got elected just in time for summit season, which is when all the world leaders get together and talk about world issues that they don't ever fix. But she had her debut this week at the East Asia Summit in Manila in the Philippines. And it's where she interacted with Donald Trump for the first time. And according to an interview she gave to a New Zealand publication earlier this week, Donald Trump pointed to a friend of his or another world leader, pointed to Jacinda Ardern and said, oh, look at her. She annoyed a lot of people in her country when she was elected. And Jacinda Ardern kind of looked at him kind of quizzically and said, what are you talking about? And he repeated the statement, said, oh, you annoyed a lot of people when you were elected. And she said, look, but at least no one marched on the street when I was elected. Which is a clear comment about the women's marches and the protest directed at Trump. But what a weird thing to say. Like, of
so
course,
weird.
When everyone wins an election, it's democracy, so there'll be some people that are upset.
There was another burn, though, wasn't there? There was something like some New Zealand press asked her, you know, what was Trump like? And she said, he's the same in private as he is in public.
Hey, I didn't even see that. That's very good.
It's also another good one.
Good honour.
Kerry, what you got?
Okay, so I don't know if you guys know Gary the Goat.
Who's Gary the Goat?
Okay, Gary the Goat is this viral goat who has, I don't know, he has a lot of influence in Queensland, and he basically goes around, follows this guy who goes to different pubs with a goat, and
he just
drinks.
Is this like an Instagram goat that we should
Yeah, this is like a big Instagram goat. Awesome. He died on tour.
No!
I know!
Oh, you just got me excited for Gary the Goat, now he's dead.
I know. I mean, well, you can do, you know, the best of hits.
Right, right.
Define on tour.
So, I think him and his owner... I don't know, partner, I guess. They go walking around just different pubs in like northern Queensland.
Okay.
And people go to these pubs just to check out this goat. And he's got a huge following. He's got a bigger following than me.
Oh, he did.
Wow.
Yeah. He's dead, I guess.
And he's dead now.
Now you can beat Gary the Goat. Cool.
Guys, check out Gary the Goat.
Can you eat Gary the Goat now?
Hot dog.
Is that weird? No.
Oh, no.
Okay,
Come on. That's not cool.
Oh, yeah, too far.
Too far.
So my endorsement is a podcast about container ships.
Oh,
riveting
stuff. Actually, it's great. It's actually a few years old. It's a podcast. It's called Containers. It's by a former or current Atlantic editor, Alexis Madrigal. And it's really fascinating. He just takes the idea of the containers that you see, you know, stacked up outside the airport and says and sort of explains historically the impact that had on the world. So funnily enough, this style of container shipping was invented during Vietnam to get all the supplies that the US soldiers in Vietnam needed down to them faster. But
Agent Orange, all the...
Exactly,
bombs,
get all that napalm straight down to Vietnam.
I'm laughing, not... Yet.
Yes, we are.
Listeners understand what my laughter is about.
Yeah. You're not laughing for napalm.
Okay, let's move on.
Anyway, I just thought it's really fascinating that he finds this... He just explains the history and how it influenced global commerce. You know, it changed our cities. It changed the way global commerce works. It means online shipping is a thing. Like,
yeah, wow.
The whole
thing.
It's worth it.
That's much more interesting than when you
said it. What's your favourite container?
Ooh.
Is Glad Wrap a container? Because I quite enjoy Glad Wrap.
It's literally those huge,
boring.
You know, iron things that people sometimes live in.
Interesting.
In the airport.
People live in them?
Well, you can turn them into, they actually make great sustainable housing.
Really?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So anyway, there's more to the eye, more than meets the eye when it comes to containerships.
Awesome.
So I recommend, I think that's all we have time for.
That is all we have time for. What a note to go out on.
Containers.
Great to have you back, Ariel. Thanks again for jumping aboard, Carrie.
Nah, you're welcome.
Special thanks to our producer, Max Chalmers, our digital producer, Natalie Sekulowska. We're going to be back next week. Ariel's not leaving us again.
No,
she's
never.
Here. Have a great weekend, team. Thanks for tuning in. Talk to you soon.